Forward to the Cloud. Okay. So I want to welcome you to our second episode of Podcasts on Partnerships. I am here with Bob Rischke from Westminster School in Atlanta, Georgia. He is the executive director of the Center for Teaching, and he is going to spend some time with us today talking about the programs that they've developed through their center, specifically a strong relationship that they have developed with Drew Charter Schools, which is also in Atlanta. So welcome, Bob. Thanks for being here with us.
Thank you. Thanks for doing this with me.
Of course. We're thrilled to have you and share your work. And I know that everybody will be excited to hear about the variety and sort of the history of how all of your multifaceted programs have come about. So if you could start by just telling me a little bit about the history of the Center for Teaching and its goals, and we'll just go from there.
Yeah, great. We were founded in 2006 through a partnership with a foundation here in Atlanta that was invested in opening a charter school. They had already opened it, but they were invested in its growth and maturation over time. And they knew that one part of that, for that trajectory to be successful, was to invest heavily in faculty professional development. So they started a partnership with Westminster School to build the Center for Teaching as a vehicle for building a bridge between Westminster and the charter school, Drew Charter School, and to really fund a program of professional growth that would in some way allow the faculty at Drew to mature and to grow the way faculty at the Westminster School had grown and matured over time as a school of excellence. And I think this foundation saw that partnership would, you know, help Drew learn from Westminster those things that make for really strong professional development programs. And our mission really is to support faculty to understand the basis and the work behind research-based best practices in the teaching profession, and learn them and integrate them into their classroom experience through job-embedded, ongoing professional development. So most of what we do falls into that category of embedded into the classroom experience that a teacher is in the midst of, and have the professional development be ongoing. So that's kind of our mission. And the partnership started between Westminster and Drew Charter School. It's grown a little bit beyond that now, but that's where it began in 2006. And I came in 2007 as the executive director.
And so when you started, was there a pedagogical philosophy that this professional development was to be based on, or was it just general overall professional development? How did you sort of focus what you guys were doing?
Well, it did. They did the search for the executive director in the first year. And then that ended up being me. When I came in 2007, I really took a rudimentary framework that they had sort of built or gotten the foundation to kind of buy into. And then I really built that framework out. So, and most of the framework that I use, at least the design principles behind the framework, align to the design framework that comes from Learning Forward. And they're 8 standards for a high quality professional learning experience. So I've used that over time, not in any rigid way, more as a philosophical foundation for how I see professional development.
And so how did you propose this work to the faculty at Westminster Schools and also to the faculty at Drew? And how did that shape out, you know, in the first couple of years?
Yeah. Well, one critical piece of the professional, there are a couple of our core elements of the professional framework in the beginning. One was to build a cross school cohort of faculty, somewhere between 5 and 6 faculty from each school, that would come together for a year and work with each other on an agreed upon set of of curricula that would tie to their classroom experience, be job embedded and ongoing. And for a year we would work together, and I facilitated that cohort. And that cohort is sort of the fundamental underpinning of how the Center for Teaching began. So I would bring together about 10 to 12 teachers, and we, in the beginning, we worked on really more pedagogy than content, because I brought together teachers from kindergarten through eighth grade, and so they all didn't have the same content background, but they did have a pedagogical kind of shared goal that they wanted to reach. And so we worked on pedagogy for a whole year. We would meet about 70 hours face-to-face hours, and then maybe 40 hours of online or virtual kind of conversations. And that cohort basically was the foundation upon which the other programs in the Center for Teaching grew. So we supported their professional development and would send them to conferences, this core group. We would do curriculum development grants to support their development of curriculum that would come out of ideas from the cohort. So in the beginning, a lot of the professional development emerged from the cohort, and then gradually new programs started to kind of blossom out of the work of the cohort in the first year or two.
So that sounds like an inordinate amount of hours for a teacher to be giving. Is there incentives for them? Do they have reduced class load? Is this all outside of their school day? How does that work?
Yeah, well, two things make it allow it to happen. One, the support of the leadership of each school. We gave each cohort member a stipend of $5,000, and most of the hours would aggregate or come from day-long meetings once a month and evening meetings about twice a month. And the day-long meetings, we would fund with stipend money that we had to support substitute teachers during the times that they would come together for a day-long meeting. And a day-long meeting would basically be 8 to 4.
Right.
So, you know, we would have 6 or 7 good working hours with each other during the day. Those are some of the incentives that went behind the program to support teachers giving the amount of time that they gave. We still do that today. I mean, that's still a part of our professional development experience.
And so as it's grown, how has it been recruiting new cohorts? It's a 1 year or a 2 year cohort?
Yeah, the first 4 years of the Center for Teaching, or maybe 5 years, the cohorts were 1 year cohorts. Then we did experiment. There came a time as I did fairly in-depth surveys of teachers throughout the experience that we found out many teachers would say, you know, 1 year isn't enough. I mean, we would use action research as the framework for the learning in the cohort and then going back to the classroom and doing the work and then coming back to the cohort with the results of the implementation in the classroom and what did we learn and what worked, what didn't work. And so in using action research, a lot of people found that they'd get to the end of the cohort of 1 year and they still had lots of questions. They still had lots of things to implement. So we did experiment for a number of years with a 2 year cohort, which I think was actually pretty successful, but it's pretty tough program to fund because you're then looking at $10,000 to $12,000 per faculty member, and it's aggregating a lot of dollars for only a few teachers. So we've moved away from that a little bit.
And so, what were the things that were the hardest for you in getting this going?
Well, one is, which is really significant from the perspective of a partnership. So Drew in Westminster has formulated over these 12 years a pretty deep partnership. But Drew is about 20 miles away from Westminster, and Drew is a charter school, chartered under the Atlanta Public Schools, so it's got a very public school kind of culture and environment and a schedule. And Westminster, as an independent school, has a very different culture and schedule. So it's hard in a partnership that you want to make deep to get the two cultures and schedules and things to marry in some way that allows faculty from each school to work seamlessly together.
Right.
And I think that's probably been the biggest challenge. We've often overcome it by having things like day-long meetings, but it's still not an easy thing to accomplish.
Have you guys jointly made concessions in things like your schedule and your professional development or what have you with as a priority for this relationship?
That's a great question. I would say the leadership from both schools has been exceedingly supportive of this initiative. And so we have made subtle concessions where, we haven't had this all the time, but we have had joint PD in-service days. And so we would coordinate our calendars so that all teachers from Drew and Westminster could come to the same campus and do professional learning together on an in-service day. So that's a way we tried to coordinate our calendars. In the beginning, we had a speaker series, so we would have to coordinate calendars to be sure that faculty from each school could come to the speaker series. In one of our cohorts, what we call the conferring cohort, and it's using some of the work of Lucy Calkins' Readers Writers Workshop and Carl Anderson's work. And we had Carl Anderson at Westminster to do master classes on the conferring process. So we were able to coordinate our schedules so all the Drew teachers could come that were in the cohort could come to the master class. So we've had some success, but it's still not the easiest thing in the world to do.
No, it seems in all this partnership work, the biggest hurdle is schedule. Kids' schedule, adult schedule, the bus schedule, it's just time.
Right.
If we could figure that out, and actually I think these types of, online congregating is actually alleviating a little bit of those problems.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yes.
So tell me how the partnership has expanded since the launching of this initial concept of a cohort and mastery teachers.
Sure. Drew has become an extremely successful charter school in Atlanta. When it was founded, it was a really failing school. And about 5 years in, there were still some challenges that the school was having. And then the Center for Teaching was designed. And around 2006, when we started through the present time, Drew is probably one of the highest performing schools in the state of Georgia. Now, that's not all due to the Center for Teaching, but we've been a part of the growth of that school over time. And around 2011 or 12, Drew Charter School got a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to build out a high school. And now it's a K-12 school of 2,000 students. And part of that grant, which was an extensive grant for building out the high school and also thinking about Drew as a successful charter school, we worked with the Boston Consulting Group to look at the replication of Drew Charter School as a replicable model for schools around the country. And Drew is part of the Eastlake redevelopment model in Eastlake of Atlanta,
right.
Which has now blossomed off an organization called Purpose Built Communities. And that organization works with communities around the country to do urban revitalization with community wellness, schooling, and other support and networks within a community to help a community grow. But the school is a central part of the purpose-built community model. And Drew, being the successful charter school in the Eastlake revitalization, it all seemed like just perfectly ripe for replicating the Drew model in other places. And so the Center for Teaching has become part of, as a consultant to purpose-built communities, which now has an organization called Purpose-Built Schools to help schools grow within their revitalization projects. So we're working with a school in Omaha, the leadership team in a school in, with a school in Omaha, in Charlotte, North Carolina, in Kansas City, and here in Atlanta, where there are some new purpose-built schools, and we're helping those leadership teams think about how do you lead a Drew Charter School model school? What are the elements of it? What goes into that happening? So the Drew Charter School model has grown, and it's become a kind of a framework for other schools to think about how to build a successful school within a revitalization community.
Now, is part of that model this professional development partnership? I mean, is that something you that you're explicitly talking about within these other communities?
We do. It's not quite as, that isn't quite, that's part of the replication of the Drew model into other schools. But the other parts of the replication sort of take higher priority. So, for example, having a strong tier one literacy program, having a strong tier one math program, having a strong response to intervention program. And Drew is a project-based learning school with a thematically focused STEAM program.
Right.
And so the project-based learning, the STEAM, the tier one literacy and math, and the response to intervention are some of the core pillars of the Drew model. So those become, have higher priority in the in, on the front end, but the professional development is a part of the model. So that gets built in as well.
Right, because when I heard you speak, I think we were at in Atlanta, at Woodward.
Yes.
You all were talking about retention rates of teachers. And can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah. Well, when Drew, around the time that the Center for Teaching was founded, one of the issues that Drew was facing is a really high turnover rate. They were upwards of 20, 25, 30% over a period of years when it was still a pretty a struggling school. And I think one of the you know, kind of driving factors in the foundation funding the beginning of the Center for Teaching was that here's this, you know, premier independent school in Atlanta that grows and hires, recruits, hires, and grows its teachers, and they stay. We have very low retention, or very high retention, excuse me. And so I think there was this idea that if whatever the secret sauce was, if we could use professional growth as a way to help Drew better retain its teachers. And over time, that is exactly what's happened. I mean, as you support teachers growing and you invest in their professional learning, they, along with the, you know, the other compensation they get, they feel really embraced by the school community and they don't have a tendency to leave. They feel their sense of commitment to the school, it gets sort of established. So I'd say that we've had some really good success with that.
I can only imagine. And that's such a it's such an indicator for success for a school, right?
Right.
Is this teacher retention or on the converse side, the attrition. So you mentioned earlier the STEAM component of Drew.
Right.
And is there that is one of these budding sort of branches of this relationship, right? Is this
yes.
a STEAM program?
Mm-hmm.
And so what is that?
Yeah, we have, we've invested heavily in professional development around science, technology, engineering, math, and the integration of arts into that that kind of constellation of disciplines where you integrate rather than separate. So we're really interested in teachers designing integrated studies, designing integrated projects, and building a more sort of relevant, meaningful curricular experience for students. So for example, we have invested heavily in Drew and Westminster teachers growing in design thinking, the maker movement, the art of tinkering, workshopping, and a variety of things of that nature. And as a result, at both schools, the programs have grown leaps and bounds. And there's a lot of coordination and partnership between faculty in each school. We run programs together. We have initiatives together. We go on trips together. So it's like reinforced the professional development experience for each school. And like, for example, right now, Drew, one of the things it's doing is in its engineering course, the students are building a tiny house for a organization here in Atlanta. They built a robotic lawnmower for a person in Eastlake who was disabled. So we try to tie a lot of projects to a sort of service learning component. But the STEAM piece is not only, it's really about trying to build it into the curriculum, not just have it be an after school experience. Get it into the curriculum through project-based learning as the kind of instructional framework.
I love hearing everything about this. Tell me, how do you think this partnership has shifted some of your faculty's day-to-day work and the way they approach their classes on a daily basis?
Well, you know, I would say when I think of Marlene Getzendaner at Westminster or Courtney Bryant at Drew, these folks have grown into designers. It's this idea of teacher as designer. So you think of the architect who's, you know, doing the drawings for a new, you know, a gorgeous building that's going up in your city. What we're seeing with people like Courtney and Marlene is they are designers of curriculum and they're creating experiences for kids that are really energizing and really impactful. So I think the impact we've had is not consciously, it's happened more unconsciously by just supporting their own curiosity and their own desire to learn. They've become really designers. And you go walk into these laboratories of Courtney and Marlene and others, and you just, you're just hit with this, like, wow, what's going on here? It's quite interesting. It looks like a tinkerer's workshop. So I'd say it's pretty energizing when you walk in and see that, and that's where the money's going.
Right. Well, and that's what kids want and families want.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that the more engaged kids are in the learning, the better their outcomes are.
Right. And, you know, I'm one of these people who feels that the whole issue around classroom management and classroom behavior and social emotional experiences in the classroom and all of that, much of it could be solved by engaging, relevant, meaningful curriculum with caring, interesting, passionate teachers. And the curriculum addresses the behavior issues, because the behavior issues are really more about disengagement and learning that isn't drawing me in. So if you draw kids in, and you can draw them in any of the disciplines, it's not about, you know, creating something that's outside the framework of what schooling has often been about. You can still write, you can still read, you can still do work on problems, but all those things have to be connected to something that's a little bit more relevant to the student, which I think the STEAM stuff and the project-based learning accomplishes.
I think so too. I read just a tweet this afternoon that a teacher had said to his class, "Well, I know that this is terribly boring to me, so it must be worse for you. So let's scrap what we're doing and redesign this lesson, because, you know, if the teacher's not engaged and modeling, you know, engaged learning, then how are the kids supposed to be doing that?"
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, that's so true, right? It just feels like, and you know, when you talk to students who say, you know, their love and their passion is math, and you follow their trajectory over time, it often is with a teacher who's inspired them.
Right.
And it isn't often, I'm guessing if we really dug under the surface of that, it isn't about the teacher who stood up and just kind of pounded data into a student's head. It's really about a teacher who cared for the student, who knew what the student was interested, who tried to tap into the interest, who tried to shape the learning environment to be a supportive, safe, and caring environment. It's, you know, it's about a lot of soft stuff, as well as, it's about content, yes, but it's also about how you set it up so that the skills and the curiosity and all of that get nurtured along with the content.
Well, and I think that's what this program is doing. It's nurturing that in the teachers so that they can remember what they are passionate about, and then that translates right directly into the classroom.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
So it leads me to my question of how are you recruiting or choosing your cohort of teachers?
Right. We've done it a number of ways. It's evolved over time. When we started, we really just had an application process, and then you based on a series of questions around, you know, your most memorable experience with a student, you know, what name, talk about a challenge you faced and how you overcame it, things of that nature. And then we would pick, you know, the 12 teachers that would be part of the cohort based on the quality of their application. Then that was fine for a while, but we realized that we were bringing kindergarten teachers in with eighth grade teachers, and we weren't curating for their own interests much. So they come together and they wouldn't necessarily have commonality. So we then shifted to designing cohorts based on themes. So we had a cohort on assessment. We had a cohort on instructional strategies. We had a cohort on the brain and learning. We had a cohort on how to become a more creative teacher. And then they were more thematic. So then we'd advertise the theme, and then that drew people in who had an interest in that theme. And then it really didn't matter if there was a kindergarten and eighth grade teacher in the same room, because if they were coming attached to the theme, then it worked out fine. So then we became more theme-based cohorts, which I think was actually the right pivot.
And so are those themes announced in advance so you can know that 2 year, I'm going to wait for 2 years because that's what I want to do?
Not quite that far. So no, not that organized.
You don't know what the hot topics are going to be, right? They just kind of emerge.
Yeah, right. I think that's right. And then they circle back, you know. I mean, when we did the brain and learning cohort was, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And really neuroscience and a lot of that wasn't in the press a lot. It wasn't in Ed Week. It wasn't in the journals much. But now, of course, it's everywhere. So it almost would be, in fact, we at Westminster were recycling into next semester. We're going to have a brain cohort experience for our faculty in the upper school. So, you know, some of these things come back to you.
So what has been your biggest surprise in the development of this, you know, this 10 years, 11 years now of this program?
Well, you know, I think it boils down to me that sort of, this is one takeaway, that when you invest in teachers working on the things that matter to them and are tied to the challenges they face in their classroom that they want to solve, but they don't have time, and you give them an experience in which they can work on that over time, and you give them the support and the facilitation, almost every teacher wants to grow. And they also experience that kind of professional development is much more impactful than going to something on a one-off basis. So, coming into this, I would have never thought, I mean, I didn't know that. I mean, I was a division director at some really good independent schools. I'd been a director of studies. I had fostered and developed teachers over time and been involved in professional development. But my vision for it was very narrow. You know, I would send people to conferences, and you know, I didn't necessarily ask them to pay their work forward. But now I have a different feeling about that. I think the more job-embedded, ongoing stuff where you're working with your peers who are equally experts in the field, and you use them to be knowledge generators as opposed to just taking it in, you get a lot of great things coming from faculty who work together. And that's sometimes better than listening to the expert.
Well, and that creates a culture of support in your school, which is, instead of there's sometimes a culture of competitiveness or something, where now you're all in it together. It's a team.
That's right. And conferences are important. I mean, I don't mean to suggest that I think conferences are really good. But the point is, I would say conferences have to learn from what we learn about professional development to structure the environment of the conference such that it kind of promotes the development of a community of practice, right? It develops the understanding of how important it is to be in a learning community. So if you have 45-minute workshops where people arrive 5 or 10 minutes late and they leave 5 or 10 minutes early, can you really do that? And so, you know, it begs the question, should conferences design learning experiences where people can sit together for longer periods of time? As an example, say.
Conference cohorts. Like you're on the purple team and you're going to travel together for 2 days.
Why not? Why not think outside the box, right? Exactly. I mean, let's get creative about how we think about that.
So what are some other things that if somebody were investigating doing this type of program that they should keep in mind prior to launching?
Well, you know, I think what we've learned, and it's so important, is you've got to have someone behind you kind of supporting your work. So we've had a local family foundation here in Atlanta that has been like super, super connected to what we've been doing. And they've supported us for now 12 years and given a lot of their, you know, hard-earned resources to our work. This work requires resources. Faculty, I think for the time they give to the kind of deep professional learning we're talking about, need compensation, but they also, even more than that, they need an investment in their own professional growth beyond the cohort experience or beyond the curriculum development grant they get. And all of that takes money. And so it's helpful to know that and have that as a pillar behind your work. I think some centers that have developed over time that I've learned about through just my own networking who don't have resources and they're expected to kind of do something new and creative without much supporting the design and creativity behind it, I don't know how they would do it because there's a, you know, faculty in independent schools are asked to wear a lot of hats.
Right.
And even in the public sector. And so there's just so much you can get out of a faculty member if you're not willing to push some resources towards them.
Right, right. There's only so much they can handle without the resources, which is what you're saying, time and financial.
Right, exactly.
And so the Family Foundation is your sole source of income for your organization?
Yeah, we started out where they were our sole source for about 4 years. And then their commitment to us was, we will keep funding you, but the two schools, Drew and Westminster, had to start putting annual operating monies into the Center for Teaching. So over time, the Cousins Family Foundation supported us 100%. And gradually, their contribution plateaued off. And then Drew and Westminster's contribution increased. And so there came a point where our operating budget was shared by both schools and our program budget was funded mostly by the foundation. So their monies, they wanted to go directly to teachers, but the operations had to be funded by the two schools over time.
That's great. That makes it institutionally sound in the long run.
Right. Right.
I think that's great. And it'll become just a normal thing for your operational budget. Once it's in there, it's easy to keep it there.
Right. Exactly.
And has there been ever a conversation about separating it away from the schools and making it a standalone 501c3?
Yeah, you know, we did talk about that at one point as a way of trying to become a more, if you will, a sustainable organization that could draw in funding from corporations, from a wider variety of stakeholders who would invest in the mission. But I would say we've never gone that route because really none of the three organizations, the foundation or the two schools wanted to fund a kind of feasibility study, if you will, to see how likely that would be to happen.
Right.
We have had other funding from another foundation here to do some other programs. So we now have an organization called Atlanta K-12 Design Challenge. If you Google that, you'll see our work. And that's funded by a different foundation, and that involves a collaboration with a variety of independent schools here in Atlanta and a set of public schools in Fulton County schools. And it's a separate initiative funded by a separate foundation. But again, all of these things, ultimately, if we were to become our separate 501c3, we'd probably have to have a board, and we'd have to, there are a lot of other things we'd have to do, which might be worthwhile looking at, but we never funded a sort of a feasibility study to see whether we could actually draw people into that kind of organization. I mean, here's a vision that is probably unrealistic, but it is, if you were in Atlanta, where there are, you know, thousands of teachers that could be served by an organization that was devoted purely to professional growth, along the philosophy and the programs that we've designed, the ideal thing would be if we were a separate 501c3 and some philanthropist dropped, you know, a $50 million endowed set of resources on us that could bleed off, you know, $2 or $3 million a year. We could presumably hire a staff and provide program support for teachers in Atlanta. But the point is, you'd need an awful lot of money to sustain an organization to support a large community of teachers in their professional development and in sort of the way we're doing it. And you know, short of that, I think, you know, what you'd find if you were a separate 501c3, you'd have to have a separate development office constantly raising money, which would just become your, you know, 40-50% of your work.
Right.
So I don't know. There is a way out of that, but I think we need some really significant person who understood the value of doing that. And I think there would be value in having an organization like that in every city.
Yeah. But
it would take a, you know, some pretty interesting folks to buy into that.
Well, and it would be interesting if you ventured into also like the public schools, you know, not just
right.
So
exactly.
Public schools could also come, because obviously they're spending millions of dollars on their teacher professional development. And how effective that professional development is. I mean, I think there's lots of studies about how that money is really not used. And I'm not speaking specifically about public schools. I'm speaking about professional development funds in general. There's very little return on the money spent on professional development.
Yes. I mean, we know that, right? That's pretty much a written fact that you can pull out 100 articles that speak to that. And what we find is, like, we're doing a partnership through Atlanta K-12 Design Challenge with Fulton County, and actually coming up in a month or so, we're going to do one of our design thinking boot camps, and we'll bring in about 100 Fulton County teachers, 70 to 100, and we do a 2-day workshop with them on design thinking. And when we survey them afterwards, it's some of the most impactful PD that they have. And that's, we contract with Fulton County to do that.
Right.
So, you know, that kind of stuff is really important. And there's a need for great professional development.
Yeah. Right. There is, but there's also a need to support our teachers. Right. So
yeah.
It goes both ways.
Right.
Well, to wrap up, first off, I could talk to you all day about this. I think it's phenomenal what you're doing. I asked the question about the 501c3 because I think like franchising, getting into different cities, how you can leverage this to help teachers across the country. And the very first way is to share this story. So thank you for joining me for the podcast. I'm interested to see how it grows because I feel like your momentum is just sort of just starting to take off, though you probably feel like 11 years has been a long time. I feel like your impact is probably just now starting to reach its true levels in terms of how many teachers you've affected and how you're creating such change on, in two different very successful and large schools, right? Neither of your schools are small. You are affecting a lot of students. Yeah. So with that, I would love to give you a chance to just speak to what this work has meant to you personally and where you see yourself with this in 5 years.
Well, you know, I think just personally, it's just great to see. For me, it's great to, I was in a conversation with a faculty member the other day, and this, in response to a question I asked this teacher, she said to me, I was asking her about professional development and how it impacted her. And she used this simple phrase, I am developed. So she feels like the work and the investment has really developed her. Well, that gives me great gratitude to know that someone has experienced professional learning that, you know, our schools and the resources we have contributed to her work. And she actually can say that she feels she's developed. I mean, the self-awareness it takes to understand that and know that about yourself is important. And so that's gratifying. And, you know, I just hope we can continue making that kind of difference for every teacher. And the teachers who are a little reticent, hopefully they learn from their colleagues like this woman and kind of get energized by and become curious about, well, how do I grow? How would I get better? How do I know I'm good enough? When is that time going to come? And what's the journey I need to take to kind of get to the point where I feel like I've arrived or I've been developed? So that's sort of, for me, was really important.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for sharing your program and your stories and your wisdom. I really can't wait to keep tabs on what's going on, and maybe I'm going to come down and visit
and come to a
master class. But anyway, thank you so much.
Well, thanks, Blake. I appreciate your work, and I certainly appreciate the organization.
Thank you for listening to episode 2 of Podcasts on Partnerships. Thanks again to Bob Rischke of Westminster School in Atlanta for taking the time to share his work with us. Remember, partnerships work. Until the next time, talk to you soon.